Welcome to Claret in Conversation, a podcast of voices from the creative industry. Here, we explain voices about how we ended up where we ended up, and we share great works of art that inspired us and that we, in turn, create. These are our first few episodes, and we're really pleased that we've had the opportunity to come together. My name is Katie Espester, and I'm the editor and publisher behind Claret Press and Clapham Publishing Services. Our guest today is Sue Carpenter, writer, filmmaker, photographer, and catalyst. Sue loves helping people from around the world through her writing and teaching, photography and filmmaking, focusing on issues that range from resurrecting dead cities to improving and empowering the lives of girls and women. The first film she produced, Educate Our Daughters, has been selected for 6 international film festivals and will premiere in the UK on the 30th of March at the UK Asian Film Festival. Her most recent work, The Wonderful Walk, is a short about a 40-meter mural for the Herne Hill Station underpass, which has set a world record. So Sue, your reputation is based on your work abroad with women and girls, including, but not exclusively, sexual slavery and the trafficking of women and girls. Now, how does someone go from Hampshire in the rural countryside to end up doing work like that?
It was not an instant leap. I would say it took quite some years. My first job was at Harper's and Queen magazine, which, as you'll know, is not known for its sort of social welfare focus, much more about fashion and society rather than social work. My initial work was going on the party circuit and doing roundups of shopping in Knightsbridge.
Well, sounds like hell, Sue.
It was. Then I went travelling, and that opened my eyes to so many different cultures and different ways of living.
When you were writing for these travel pieces, were you working freelance, or were you on... was this a salaried position with a newspaper?
I worked for Harper's and Queen for about 4 years. And then because I wanted to go around the world, I left to do that. So I went away for about nearly a year. And
you were writing articles through this year, or was it just purely traveling?
It was mostly traveling, but I was kind of picking up ideas for articles. And then actually I was meant to go and work for Harper's Australia, but there was a visa problem, so I never was able to. But I worked for various magazines when I got as far as Australia. Then I came home, and then I did more freelance work. I've basically been freelance ever since then. And so it was a subsequent trip. I used to freelance for a while, and then I'd get itchy feet and I'd go traveling for a while.
And that is the great advantage of being both in the creative industry and being freelance, is that no matter what you're doing, you can pick up ideas.
Yeah.
You go traveling, it's not just a holiday, it's a churn of ideas and mulling things over that will then feed into your later work. As well as, of course, you know, having a really good time.
Exactly.
So when you left Harper and Queen, this sounds like a real life change, a real shift of direction.
Yeah, I guess it was. I mean, Hampshire, you know, is not exactly the most open-eyed, outward-facing county in Britain. It's very Middle England-y, and, you know, I didn't really have any idea about the big wide world except through my Ladybird books of India, etc. But, I mean, they really were. I remember poring over those as a child. So, obviously, that travel bug had been instilled in me from there. And I used to love looking at maps, atlases. You know, I get so excited drawing pictures of, yeah, we used to have, in geography, had to draw maps, and I love drawing India.
Oh, it sounds like you're a bit of a Victorian explorer type. You know, the lady explorer who then, like Gertrude Bell and women like that who drew maps and went exploring just, you know, a century after them.
Yes. Yeah, Victorian was about what Hampshire was like at that time. Not quite so long ago. But yeah, so off I went, And I did keep going back to India. That was a particular pull.
It called to you, did it?
Subcontinent, I guess. You know, and we read A Passage to India was one of my favourite novels.
As it is for many people, yes. Mm.
So I set up, well, I wrote an article about this city, which I found when I got there, this beautiful fortress city right on the edge of Rajasthan, which looks like something out of Arabian Nights, and was falling down. And they just had a terrible storm and many buildings had fallen down. And I met the conservation architect who was working there, and he said, if we don't have an international spotlight on this place, it'll be just crumbling into dust and it'll become part of the desert.
Goodness.
So I went back, wrote an article about it. I had a contact at the time at New Scientist, so it was quite a kind of serious journal that I got my piece into, and was quite technical. And so that then meant that loads of people wrote in, and the whole thing snowballed, and I ended up setting up a charity, Jaisalmer in Jeopardy, to try and save it.
That's extraordinary, Sue. So it just seems almost larger than life. There is a crumbling city, and you almost stumble across it, and then spearhead an effort to preserve it for the coming generations. On behalf of humanity, can I say thank you very much?
thank you. Well, I definitely, you know,
greatly appreciated. I must go there someday.
Yeah, well, it's the most beautiful place. But like so many places, of course, tourism has now invaded so much that it has lost some of its charm. But it was largely because of tourists that the place was falling down, because everybody was setting up all the houses inside the city. Were turning themselves into little hotels, and then because they were using so much more water than originally had been planned for this dry stone city, it was all going in cracks under the foundations. The whole place was falling down like a sandcastle. But yeah, so we did do quite a few projects there. There was a whole sewage system put in. We connected all the householders up to the sewage system, repaired all the drains, repaired the streets, put back together some of the beautiful palaces that have fallen down. So, you know, it's going to last a bit longer.
It sounds very inspirational. And how did having this, it sounds a bit accidental, but this extraordinary drive to protect an ancient city turn into your work dealing with Nepal?
Well, I guess it set up, it sort of ignited a sense of social conscience and doing something for others, which was not in the sort of Harpers and Queen DNA. And also it was very much the same part of the world. But
it's clearly in your DNA, Sue.
Yeah, it's in there. My mum was, you know, she was chairman of the local RNLI and was always doing things for other people. So it sort of was latent in me, very latent. Yeah. She would have not realised it was there.
It came by it honestly.
So I kept on travelling, and then I started doing a lot of work for You magazine, which is the Mail on Sunday supplement, which for a while in the 90s was just a really great magazine that did a lot of articles that were very accessible for the general public, but that really tackled quite important issues. And so for them, I wrote, for example, about a woman who was saving street kids in Mongolia, and quite a few sort of social type issues overseas. And then I started doing more and more photography to support my articles, reportage type photography.
So just nuts and bolts here for people who are in the creative industry and want or maybe they're not in it, but they're curious about how this works. You would be paid per article and then paid per photograph as well?
It pretty much was like that. But honestly, I don't think it's like that anymore. I used to do quite a lot of just straight travel writing as well, and I'd do my own photos for that. And I'd get paid anything between £500 to £1,000 for a travel article. Now you'll be lucky to get 100. I mean, it's just appalling. It's so difficult to make money through journalism now. But because we're far fewer magazines and newspapers, and the internet didn't really exist then, the 90s, I think, you know, that was sort of very early days. Mm-hmm. And So you weren't ever doing things for online publications. You were just doing it for print publications. And so there was more money to be able to be concentrated into those fields. But yes. Now everybody is trying to be a creative. And although there are far many more outlets, they all give you so little money that you have to do, instead of, I could just do one article and then the picture desk would pay me for the photos as well. And I'd come home with £1,000 as well as a free trip. Very nice, thank you. But I'm afraid these days that is just not on the cards.
That's the way it used to be.
That is the way it used to be.
Yeah.
But I preferred not to do straight travel. I preferred when there was an issue there because it was just so much more interesting and much more of a story.
Well, it's not just that. I think when we have an issue, we see the things that can, in my opinion, we see the things that connect us. You know, our changing climate means there's wildfires now in places where they shouldn't have been, not just in India and California, but also in Canada. Where I come from, we don't get wildfires, we do now. So you look at other communities that are suddenly got this new, very terrifying threat. And you think, in Canada, we can just fight it because we're still a wealthy nation. Those poor people who don't come from as wealthy a world, as wealthy a country as we come from, with their wildfire and the water problems.
Yeah, of course.
It makes you see the humanity beneath us all.
Yes, absolutely. And India and Nepal are places that are suffering more than any because there's such a massive population of people who are way below the poverty line, and there's a lot of corruption in government, and those people suffer a lot. And of course women are at the bottom of the heap, and gradually I became more and more sensitized to those kinds of issues from traveling. And then there was a pivotal article that I did for You magazine about a woman who was rescuing girls who'd been trafficked from Nepal, from remote villages, where they're so ignorant because girls don't get much of an education in Nepal. They're very lucky if they go to school at all. Girls are treated below boys, so that if you have one boy and three girls in your family, the three girls will be working in the fields and doing the domestic chores, and the boy will be sent to school, and he'll be saved the best food. He'll eat first, and then the girls.
So still, is that going on today, still?
It still goes on. I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of work to try and improve things.
Well, partially thanks to you, Sue.
Well, in a very, very small way. But, you know, obviously, a lot of organisations are trying to tackle this. But anyway, so I went to do this piece and spent a week out there and traveled to different villages and met these girls who'd had the most terrible traumatic experiences.
And how did you meet them? Like, what was the you can't just walk into a village and say, "Hi, I'm Sue, let's talk."
No, well, it was through the woman who had set up an organization to try and help some of these girls and set up a refuge for them. And I actually met three girls who had escaped from a brothel in India. The trafficking is mainly from Nepal into India, and then it's to Calcutta, to Bombay is the big one. And these girls, one of them had jumped out of a third floor window to get away and had broken her back. And the other two, one broke a leg. I mean, it was just terrible. And these girls had just, you know, limped, dragged each other to somewhere. And some man had seen them and, thank God, was a decent man and had got them onto a train, and they got across the border and they to a refuge. Anyway, there's a whole chain of people who are working to try and combat these terrible, evil practices. So this was a refuge in Kathmandu to try and help these girls. And I wrote this article. And meanwhile, there was a man named Peter Bashford, who was a British guy who'd been working in the rag trade in Asia and had been thinking, I want to give something back to society. And he had gone to see Sai Baba, who was a sort of guru that he followed in India. and said, what should I do? You know, I feel I want to change direction and do something. And Sai Baba said, go back home and you will find the answer, which I didn't think was very enlightening, but he did it.
Well, there we go. And when I guess it was enlightening then.
When he got back, the first thing that he opened and read was my article, and he decided to devote the rest of his life to supporting these women in Nepal. And wow. So he wrote to me and said, would I help set up a charity? And
I can kind of get over how accidental this all is.
But I guess that's what life is, isn't it? It's a series of coincidences, being in one place at the time when something happens. I mean, I do find that quite a sort of extraordinary story myself, that's how he came to be interested in this.
It's the kind of the chance encounters changing lives.
Exactly. If he'd turned over the other page and hadn't seen it, that would have been that. Yeah. But so he got me involved, and we set up this charity that's called Asha Nepal, and which means hope. Asha is hope. Nepal.
Yes.
And
obviously at that point you'd been to Nepal and you'd were familiar with the situation, and you were how many times had you been back and forth to Nepal?
I think I'd been maybe two or three times.
I see. So you had a good working knowledge then of the country.
Ooh, I would say I didn't really get a good working knowledge till I went to live there. There are so many layers.
You lived there?
Well, what happened next is the Asha Nepal, setting it up, went back out on a site visit with Peter, and by that stage, they weren't just helping women who'd been trafficked, but they were also taking in homeless children or abandoned children and babies. And a baby was put into my arms, and the woman who ran the place said, this is Simran, and she hates loud noises. And then she sort of went bam, 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 and smacked her sort of hands like this in this poor baby's face, and the baby started crying. And I just thought, that little innocent baby being brought up in this place, this all seems very odd. And I started asking around about what people felt about adoption, and maybe should this little baby, if it was orphaned, would it be better to be living with a mother in another country or to be living in an institution in her own culture? And everyone said, above all, a baby needs a mother.
Or a father. I have to say, in fairness, I say this as a woman, but babies need parents. Yeah.
A primary carer who will love that baby as their 100% top priority.
Absolutely. I've got absolutely no doubt in my mind that nobody can replace a parent, not an institution, certainly.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. I mean, obviously, if there'd been a primary carer there who was looking after several children, and in not the Western way, but in a Nepali way, that would be fantastic. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess I would have thought was the best option. But there was nobody to do that. It was an institution or me or someone. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I decided that I was going to try and adopt her, which I did.
How lovely.
So that's the story of Simi coming into my life.
So it's extraordinary that the kind of the dots that I'm connecting here, you know, this, you start off doing freelance writing because you're, you know, in effect, it almost squares the circle for you. You get to travel and you get paid to travel and you get to engage deeply with issues. And while you're doing this, more ideas come out. And this is almost the best case scenario for working as a freelance writer. And then to top it all off, you get a child out of it.
Mm-hmm.
What a gift. Like what a fantastic endorsement of the life you've chosen, is that you've not just made the world a better place for other people, but you get a baby too. The universe is generous, Sue.
Yeah. Then after I had Simi, what happened after that was Asha Nepal carried on operating. And then my work of inspiration that I went to see when Simmy was, I suppose, four-ish. Yeah, I think she was just four. So I'd only had her for about a year and a half, because it took a while, the whole adoption process.
Yes, I'm sure it did.
I went to see a film called Born into Brothels. And
who was the director of that?
She's called Zana Brisky, and she was a photographer from America, and was doing a long project immersing herself in the life of brothels in Calcutta. And she was a serious photojournalist documenting the lives of these women.
And this movie went on to win, practically, it swept the boards in 2005. If there was an award, it won it, this particular documentary. So I'm not surprised that not merely did you watch it, you found it inspirational. I think it changed a number of people's lives.
Yeah, absolutely. It was just one of those films that, obviously, I've already told you that I'm interested in India, and I love beautiful visuals and so on, and human stories. So it brought all those things together.
Yeah.
But the minute it opened, I can really picture the opening of, I think there was a fly buzzing around a bare light bulb in a black room. And then you get to see children's eyes, and you get to see the streets and all the kind of colour and texture of life in those really horrible, seedy slums of India. And yet there's this immense beauty in it as well, with those kind of peppermint green doors and the pink saris.
There's a visual feast.
Yeah.
Both good and bad.
Yeah, exactly. There's this visual beauty, and yet behind the scenes, these despicable things going on.
Those poor children.
And so the children were the children of the prostitutes who are being brought up in that world, and that is their world. They can't get out of it.
But it was more than just the beauty that affected you, eh, Sue?
Yeah, of course. I mean, those children, there they are. What can they do? But Zana was there, and she started thinking, maybe they'd like to pick up a camera. Let's see I can teach them photography, because they're not going to school. Education, was given such low priority. I mean, this is already 15 years ago, that film. And I think things have changed a lot more in the past 15 years about the importance of education for everybody, but particularly for girls around the world. We now realise that it's absolutely paramount.
It's the key indicator,
isn't
it?
It is the
keystone.
Absolute key. Because if the girls, for girls particularly, because if the girls are educated, they also learn about healthcare and hygiene, and then they spread that in their home, the messages of good health and hygiene. So it completely improves the outcomes for families, the sort of child mortality rate, the healthcare, etc. It's got a lot of ripple effects. It's not just, now I can spell my name.
Yes. And then so Zana gave cameras to these kids.
Yes.
And you kind of borrowed the idea.
Yeah, I did. I did steal the idea. Yeah, I actually did contact her, in the early days. I don't know whether she'd have time to email me these days, but then I emailed her and said, I want to do something the same as you did. It's just so amazing. And I'm connected to Nepal and a charity there. And so we had a few
emails. Oh, bless her heart. She emailed you back.
Yeah. We had a few emails, and she just gave me some tips and ideas. And there were a few organizations doing similar kinds of things.
There is something quite powerful about putting a device, whether it's a pen in the hands of a writer or a camera in the hands of a person who can take a good photograph, and people documenting their own lives.
Exactly.
As reality TV has demonstrated, indeed as podcasts, like we're right now, we're an example of it. It's the authenticity of real people, reflecting and producing about their own lives for their own community, not necessarily for an international community or a national community, but for their own community. I think we underestimate the power of a local voice to talk about local issues in a local tone of voice.
Yeah.
Because I think one of the things about when we can document our own lives is that we can then engage in a dialogue about what we see. And suddenly we're seeing our own lives that we have taken about ourselves, and we get a perspective and an understanding, and it enriches our own consciousness. It deepens our consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in so many ways it works. It's of course, having agency to do what one wants and to feel what one feels and to be able to express that is just, you know, just is so enlightening and empowering to everybody. You know, if you imagine those girls in Nepal, the way they live their lives is one of suppression. They're always an adjunct to a man. They're never somebody in their own right. The sort of rural, low-caste girls who make up about half the population. Yes. You know, it's not that they're in a small minority.
But you went and changed it. Tried to change it. You were a little bit a part of it.
So I went to Pokhara in West Nepal, about 7-hour dusty old train ride away, or not train, car ride away from Kathmandu. And I taught photography to a group of girls who had come from disadvantaged backgrounds, various different things in their backgrounds. And one of those girls was called Belmaya. And she was particularly captivating for me because she had such a strong will and voice and energy to her. And a lot of the girls who'd been used to being suppressed were much more timid and submissive, and they enjoyed picking up the cameras and taking photos, but they kind of were still trying to conform. And Belmaya is one of nature's non-conformists. You know, she wanted to do everything the different way and kick up a bit of hell
rays. We need more. We everybody should kick up a bit of hell. Not just girls in Nepal, but we all should.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, that now, you know, girl power, that's what it's about, isn't it? It's just being able to express yourself and be who you are and tell the world about it. But that it's a million miles away from what Nepal is like and about and the consciousness there. And
I can't imagine that anybody rewarded her for kicking uphill.
No, exactly. She was always getting told off and being sent into the office and, if not whacked. Well, yeah, they used to do a few little nasty things there. Things like they put the pencil weaving between the fingers and then would press down on their fingers.
Ow.
And a few, you know, raps with a ruler and so on, and being shouted at. Yeah. So that's life there if you step out of line.
Yes, and I would imagine it goes from there. That's what they do in front of a nice Westerner who's coming to...
Well, they didn't do that in front of me. That I learnt from the girls was going on behind the scenes. No, in front of me, everything was very nice.
Yes.
And all very decorous.
Yeah.
But the girls, you could see them visibly. The minute the management walked in, the girls would shut down and be very, very submissive and polite. And then when they went, they'd get me to put on ABBA songs and they'd dance on the tables.
Dancing queen. I like that.
Yeah. No, they love dancing. That would have been their two loves, were the photography and the dancing.
Wow, yes.
So, I did my photo project. We got some funding from the British Council to have exhibitions and create a book, which it was called My World, My View. But then I came home. My visa, you know, you only can get a maximum of 9-10 months visa. You do two. You're allowed 5 months in a year, so you do 2 years back to back and max out your visa. And then I had to go home, and I lost touch with the girls. Basically, they all moved on. But lingering in my mind was footage I'd taken. I did some film footage as well, just on a little Sony Handycam. I didn't have, well, there wasn't sophisticated digital equipment at that stage, or at least certainly not that I would have known how to operate, not that I could fit in my suitcase. So I had this beautiful footage of Belmaya dancing, wearing pink, and just the absolute epitome of joy and carefreeness, which was so opposite to actually what most of her life had been. And I just thought I would so love to make a film about her. And then I heard about this man who was teaching filmmaking just as I'd been teaching photography to girls to empower them and to give them a voice. And he was Nepali and he'd worked with rural girls in Nepal and had great success. He'd made really interesting stories about aspects of their lives. And so I somehow found Belmaya, who by that stage got married and had a baby and was living in terrible poverty, and the husband was quite abusive.
Yes.
And
how sad.
I know, very sad. And I went out there and saw her, and you know, she was really, she'd kind of given up hope. Aww. I was asking her, what would you do in your dreams if you could choose what happened next in your life? And she just looked confused by the question, because it was out of the question as far as she was concerned. And she just said, I don't think I'll ever see happiness in my life. And that was at the age of 21.
That's very sad.
Yeah.
And how did she respond when you showed up in her life?
Well, I think she was full of, although hopeless, she was also at the same time full of hope that I would somehow change things.
Yes.
Like I was
a fairy
very,
godmother.
Yeah,
almost.
Exactly.
Which puts
was
you in an awkward position of being a fairy godmother.
Yeah, very uncomfortable. And of course, not what I wanted to be about at all. I was all wanting to be about giving agency to the person.
You want her to be your own fairy godmother.
Yeah, exactly. To give her the tools to wave her own wand. If that's a bit of a mixed metaphor.
No, let's say it isn't. Let's say it's not a mixed metaphor.
So this seemed to be a potential way of doing that I would assist with getting this guy to be able to train her and to facilitate that. And she would then tell her own story through film.
And how did that end up, Sue?
Well, it's ended up amazingly.
Fantastic. Tell us about it.
Fast forward. I started making a film about the whole process. So I've watched the whole journey of her transformation. I mean, things got, first of all, from bad to worse with the husband. But then there was this pivotal moment where she called the police on her husband after he'd whacked her one. And he went to jail for a few days and he came out a slightly reformed man. And so...
Oh, good.
Then supported her much more in her work.
So initially he put the brakes on and said, yeah. No, you can't do this, you can't do that, and
yeah.
You'll be a good wife and
he
go.
He was resentful, you know, why was this woman who's meant to do what he says and who's meant to look after the house and the baby going out to learn filmmaking? How did that fit into his world? And he'd had no education either, you know, he's from a flawed family life too.
Yes.
So he was trying to stop that and resentful that she was doing it. But he came round and she made a film. And the film she's made is That's Educate Our Daughters. And it's...
That is the one that is now being opened in... Sue,
yeah,
help me out
The UK Asian Film Festival.
And when is that, Sue?
It's the 30th of March. It's screening.
Well, I certainly
Saturday,
hope that.
And it's... She's up for the short film competition award. They've selected 10 films from around the world, and hers is one of them.
I doubt that this podcast will be out in time, but we can do an update and stick it on.
So the film is about the fact that she, Belmaya, didn't have an education because she absolutely was discriminated against. She had 4 elder brothers and 1 elder sister, and her sister and her had to fend for themselves and steal plums off the neighbor's tree because they were starving and work in the fields.
But so how did it... I see you down here as the producer.
Yes.
Now, how did that come about?
Well, because I was making the film about her.
Mm-hmm.
When I was out there, you know, I was encouraging her to complete her film. She had this idea, but, you know, obviously it's a big, tall order for someone who is not, she's barely literate, she's not computer literate, and she's become camera literate, but she definitely needed help with the editing. So I went with a Nepali filmmaker and she and I assisted her to get the story together and complete the film.
Wonderful. And then you got it on the International Film Festival.
Yeah, and I've been, yes, doing that. I've been sending it out to different film festivals, and she was selected for the Toronto Real Asian, not TIFF, but the Toronto International Film Festival, but the Toronto Real Asian Film Festival, which is still a very prestigious yes. one.
Toronto has a huge Asian community. Mm. I mean, absolutely ginormous.
Yeah, exactly. So. And we tried to get Balmire out there, but a visa was not forthcoming.
Yes, that's unfortunate.
And she got into the Chicago International South Asian Film Festival and various others, but now UK. And the amazing thing is she's coming over here. We have got her a visa to come to the UK. So this is going to be the first time out of Nepal ever in a plane, ever out of Nepal. It's going to be such a major deal for her.
And will you be filming this? Yes. Or will somebody be filming this? Because this is... you know, to go from rural Nepal to London, Regent Street, no less, where the film launch is going to be held. Gosh, I actually kind of almost, you know, I feel for the child. It's mm-hmm. like, whoa, that's a transition she's going to be making in 15 hours of flying or whatever it happens to be.
Yeah,
that's going to be tough. Yeah. But good for her for doing it.
Yeah, it is. I keep thinking I've got the finale to my film. First of all, she showed her film.
Wait a minute, tell us about your film some more.
So my film is called I Am Balmire. And in a way, it's like her little film writ large.
I see.
It's the story of her life picking up from 2014 when she started learning filmmaking and following her with her domestic family relationship with her husband being very tempestuous and difficult. And but ultimately finding their way together. And at the same time with her becoming more and more independent and more empowered through putting, instead of the bamboo basket full of logs on her back, putting a tripod on her back, and off she goes up into the mountains filming.
So kind of just to put this into a language I would understand, Balmire short that is being shown in London on March 30th is like an autobiography and a reflection on what needs to be done. Whereas your film is it feature length?
Yeah, my film is feature length. So mine is observing her from the outside, although, you know, it becomes all a bit self-referential and difficult to understand maybe because she gradually takes over the camera herself, we intersperse. My film intersperses the observed footage from me and other outside camera people with Balmire's own footage. So
you quote her, in effect.
Well, I guess in a way, yes. It's like passages of that she's written herself, but it's things. And there's a kind of device we put on of the kind of recording time code and a little red dot so people realise this is her footage.
Yes.
But she sets up an interview, for example, with herself and her husband. And, you know, it's very charming because you see that the camera's sort of moving up and down and focusing in and out until she gets it right. And then she emerges in front of the camera and sits down with her husband and says, right, okay, now I'm going to interview you.
Yeah.
And she's quite feisty. She says, so why didn't you want me to do this filmmaking at first? You were very hostile about it. What was that all about? You know, she's good.
Excellent.
She's good.
And when does your film come out, Sue?
So my film, well, I'm editing it at the moment. But as I say, I keep thinking I've got the finale. And now we've got another finale, which is her going to present her film in the UK. So I'm planning just a little addendum of, you know, arriving off the plane and big wide eyes and then...
Gosh, it sounds exciting.
Hopefully and picking up her award. Who knows?
And do you hope to... Obviously, I would imagine trying to get a distributor for that film.
Yes, yes. So that's, I mean, as everyone says, the creating your film is only half the battle is making it, and then it's getting it out there, marketing it, distributing it. So, yeah, what comes next is I'll finish editing it. Hopefully we'll get some favours in for post-production because I'll be so amazed at the quality and amazement, you know, the wonderment
Absolutely.
Of Balmire's story.
Absolutely.
And then, yes, start trying to get it out there to festivals again. You know, that it's a very good route to show things at festivals because the industry are there, the audience, you get audience awards and audience attention, press attention, and then the more conservative commissioning broadcasters might come in at that point and say, actually, this is rather good. Can we have it, please?
This is a journey that started in 2005.
Yes.
And is now wrapping up kind of 15
probably
years later.
Probably 2020, I guess, yeah, by the time. It'll probably be on general release 2020. Hopefully we might, I'm not sure, but we might premiere this year at the Kathmandu Film Festival.
And what's next for you, Sue?
Oh, gosh. Oh. I do have an idea, actually, for a London film, easier, closer to home. And I've been making my Herne Hill film.
Well, yes, the one that set a world record.
Yes.
That sounds...
Yes.
How does a film... How does that...
The film is about the Herne Hill underpass and mural that was created by over 2,000 people, colouring it in.
I see it's a 40-metre mural.
40 metres long, yes.
Good
it's
Lord.
Really long.
I've been in the underpass at Herne Hill. It's not 40 metres,
it
surely.
It is 40 metres.
Is that 40 metres?
It's over two double-decker buses you could get down that
wow.
tunnel if it was
okay.
a bit taller.
I'll have to go back and take another look at it because it didn't feel like 40 metres when I was under there. So you've now got a mural running the length of the Herne
well,
Hill underpass.
Well, it's not actually put in situ yet, but
okay.
it will be very
will be.
Soon. So again, it's like all my films have this slightly open, vacant bit at the end waiting for the final scene. So I'm waiting for my final scene of the mural to be put in situ. It was made on fabric because there was no way we could get 2,000 people into the tunnel to colour it in.
Yes.
So we did it in Station Hall above the station in sections and then it'll all be mounted and put into the tunnel.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
It sounds to me, Sue, as if... Your creative journey is not just you being a creative artist in your own right, but you acting as a catalyst for other people to engage in a creative journey. Like the ripple effect from the work that you do, and it may just be one person with Belmaya or just one whole city in Rajasthan, or just one small community in Herne Hill, but you have left a legacy and an imprint that most artists would gnaw off the left arms for. You know, congratulations.
Thank you.
Make sure you rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. And follow us on Facebook or subscribe to our newsletter to keep up with the latest news, events, and podcast updates. The newsletter is available through our Claret Press website or our Clapham Publishing Services website. Claret in Conversation is hosted by myself, Katie. It's produced by Alex Holmes and edited and engineered by Chelsea Moore. We've had additional assistance from Hugo Zhang.